Welcome to the Phil Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 1:30 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time, and today is August 7th. And of course, today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. But I thought we'd kick off today with the long-term chart of gold adjusted for the purchasing power parity of the US dollar. And what I find particularly interesting is the fact that it peaked back in 2011 in close proximity to the peaks put in all the way back in 1980. I think one thing that's rather interesting is that when you look at it on a daily basis, then the peak is somewhere around 280 in 2011, and then all the way up, because around 371 for 1980, because that it was really an intra-week peak that got all the way up to those levels, and it wasn't really sustained. Well, it also helps to highlight that the panicky environment that creates these kinds of extraordinary accelerations does not persist indefinitely, and that when they pull back, they can pull back extremely violently. That's something that I think everyone needs to pay attention to right now, because we've got plenty of evidence of acceleration, particularly in the technology sector. But we'll certainly cover that in more detail later in the broadcast. A couple of things that I would definitely want to touch on this week are precious metal markets, because they've done so spectacularly well in just a very short period of time. The FANGs, because they've been doing spectacularly well for the last 12 years and are now accelerating. But then also to look at some of the emerging technologies that are likely to shape what's coming in the next decade. Because we can start to think about the 1990s, the 2000s, and the tweens as different phases in the technology sector. So if we think about the 1990s, it was really all about the internet and the creation of the internet and the enthusiasm that had emerged in the aftermath of the end of the Cold War that created bubbly activity in the late 1990s. Then when we think about in the 2000s, well, it was more about commodities and the emergence of China and less about technological innovation, even though one thing that tends to escape the attention of most investors is that the technological development cycle runs independently of the market cycle. So you're going to have people that are working in universities and labs all over the world that their work is occurring independently of the market cycle. But it is usually during times of extraordinarily low interest rates that money gets thrown at these high growth potential markets, simply because there is a dearth of opportunity everywhere else. Well, we've had a really quite prolonged period where commodities haven't done much of anything. The main commodity markets peaked in 2011, so it's been a long decade where we've had the evolution of technology doing really very, very well, and commodities not doing well at all. Now we're coming into the beginning of a new decade, and technology has done spectacularly well, and commodities have done really quite poorly until quite recently. So it does beg the question, should we be looking more at the technology sector or the commodities sector going forward for the next decade? Because on a relative value basis, technology and large cap growth generally, what's particularly interesting is that the large cap growth sector is completely dominated by the big technology companies. The much touted strength of the ESG sector, which is environmental, social, and governance, and that is also heavily dominated by the large cap growth companies. Then the major indices are heavily dominated by the large cap growth sectors. So these, I think, are very important things to pay attention to, because when we think about the outlook for the next decade, it is very likely to have an impact. We can certainly think about what's going on in terms of the wider world as well. Because the one thing that has done particularly well over the last 40 years have been bonds. The bond yield peaked in 1980 and has been compressing since then. And despite many calls and gnashing of teeth from the bears over that entire period, the compression of yields has persisted, so that now we have 90% of all bonds, or all sovereign bonds, are trading at yields below 1%. One of the, I think, the most correct ways of thinking about gold as a store of value is more to think about it as a zero coupon bond with no maturity. And that is one of the factors that really tends to bolster the attraction of it for fixed income investors when they have no choice. Gold at least has the potential to rise in a really quite accelerated fashion, and we've certainly seen that in just the last 3 weeks alone. On a purchasing power parity basis, it is quite likely that we're going to see gold in US dollar terms exceed the peak from 2011 and 1980 before this bull market has run its course. And it's worth reminding ourselves that the last big bull market in gold lasted a decade. The last big bull market in gold prior to that also lasted a decade. Now, after that big move, we had a very prolonged bear market. On this occasion, the bear market has not been nearly as long, and we've had a substantial breakout over the last 12 months. It would suggest, however, that we have at least a few years more of additional upside, potentially even a decade, and that this is really a market that has got plenty of scope to continue to advance, because governments all over the world are in a rather difficult position. They have got walls of debt, and they are completely dependent on yields staying down. So the 10-year yield is around 50 basis points, and we did have some flirting with negative yields at the very short end of the curve back in March, but the lack of volatility in treasuries has been something really quite profound over the course of the last few months, and there is still a wide overextension relative to the trend mean. We also have the condition here that there are questions starting to be asked about the sustainability of this massive spending program and the willingness of investors to tolerate it. One of the biggest mistakes I think that people are making is to compare what's going on in the rest of the world with what happened in Japan. The one big benefit that Japan had over the rest of the world in printing as so much debt and the compression of yields and the movement into negative yielding territory back in 2016, and the fact that they have been engaged with zero interest rate policy for such a prolonged period, was the availability of higher yielding assets everywhere else. That pretty much ensured that there was a yen carry trade, that the proverbial Mrs. Watanabe, but perhaps more accurately the big insurance companies in Japan, moved money overseas, were able to capture a higher yield internationally, and that allowed the domestic market to stay at very low interest rates, because there were alternatives for the banking sector, for the insurance sectors, to escape the low interest rate environment. It didn't necessarily mean that they were going to trend higher in a very impressive manner, and the banking sector has been mired in a difficult trading environment for a long time, with occasional pops on the upside. But the availability of higher yielding assets internationally did afford Japan the opportunity to stay on low interest rates for a long time in an effort to combat their domestic deflation, which essentially was a very lengthy period of trying to work off the speculative excesses from the late 1980s. Of course, today we have got every country that has been cutting interest rates, and the range of alternatives where an investor can go to capture a yield is now very much more or much smaller than it used to be. And that is raising important questions about the sustainability of the continued surge in the quantity of debt outstanding. So governments are continuing to print money, and that is continuing to inflate the size of their respective balance sheets. So this long-term chart of the size of the Fed's balance sheet and every other major central bank's balance sheet redenominated into US dollars has been trending higher now for years. It's now north of 27 trillion, and this has been a very substantial acceleration since March, where it has gone from about 20.5 to 27, so $6.5 trillion worth of accommodation from various central banks around the world in just the last few months is enough to buy a bull market. And that is exactly what they've done. So, of course, there is the other side of this equation, and it is to think, well, they have increased the asset prices for everything over the course of the last 4 months, and that is likely to persist as long as they're continuing to increase the size of their balance sheets. But of course, this obviously then also has to, I think there's two big conclusions that we can take from this data. The first is that every time over the last decade we've seen a central bank try to reduce the size of its balance sheet, they failed. Because when we look at, for example, the Federal Reserve's balance sheet, they tried to reduce the size of the balance sheet. They went through a period of quantitative tightening from the beginning of 2018 into the latter portion of 2019, and they were on the cusp of causing a recession. So now we've had this massive increase in the size of the balance sheet, and it was totally predictable. Veteran subscribers will recall that I've been looking at the size of the ECB's balance sheet for a prolonged period, and they did exactly the same thing in 2013 and 14. They took €1 trillion out of circulation and to try and undo the damage done and the deflation that that caused, they ended up having to put in €2.5 trillion, having taken out one. And with the new crisis that has evolved this year, they've had to increase again by an additional €2 trillion in a short period of time. So one thing that we can certainly say is that central banks have learned their lesson. They are not going to reduce the size of their balance sheets while they have got any doubt at all about the trajectory of inflation. What it basically means is they are going to maintain the size of their balance sheets until well after inflation is clearly evident. They have absolutely no choice in that matter, because any time a central bank has tried to reduce the size of their balance sheet, they've caused a recession. And the last thing they can do today is try and cause a recession, since we are in the middle of one of the deepest contractions in history. And therefore, the size of the balance sheets is only going to continue to increase. There is going to be a phenomenal quantity of money printed. Now, what uses that money is going to be put to is an open question, but the clear intention of central banks all over the world is to massively increase the money supply. Now, when we look at the velocity of money, well, it has contracted meaningfully. It was last updated for the end of June, and that's reflecting activity in the first quarter, not the second quarter. So when we then think about what this means, it's quite clear. If velocity of money is very low, then the supply of money can be very high without causing an inflationary outcome. It's when we start to get an economic recovery that inflationary pressures start to rise. Now, one thing that I thought was interesting over the course of the last day, or I guess over the last couple of months, is that the median home price has increased substantially. So it was higher in 2019 than 18, which is, I think, a measure of home price appreciation. The size of the increase that we've had in the median home price for houses sold over the course of the last 3 or 4 months is less to do with the purchase price increase, but rather that there is increased demand for bigger houses. Now, that's the logical conclusion. When people look at the desire for remote work, for working from home, then you do need a somewhat larger home to accommodate an additional office, or indeed two offices, additional play areas for kids. So there is obviously some demand for additional housing. However, there is the additional point that if you are going to benefit from inflation, locking down extraordinarily low interest rates in a mortgage at current levels makes sense if you think that inflation is going to take over, and that inflationary pressures would then erode the higher price paid today for a home. So that could also potentially now be figuring into these factors. So are people starting to preempt inflation? Now, there's an additional question as well. Because there has been no, there hasn't been any travel, there haven't been any business meetings, there haven't been any conferences. For small business owners, these are some of the biggest tax write-offs. Going to a conference can be rolled into a family holiday. If, for example, I go for a conference and I decide to take my family with me, well, it's one hotel and it's one room. It can be any room, can be written off. So if I get a suite or I get a room with two queen beds, my whole family can have a holiday, but I get to write the whole thing off as a business expense. These are the kinds of expenses that small business owners take on an annual basis. It's then when we think about technology purchases, furniture purchases for home offices, these are all the kinds of things that people who work from home take regularly as deductions on their taxation. And it's also something that affects the demand for vehicles, as people look for company cars, or if they work from home or they're independent contractors, then they can write off their part of their vehicle. Or if they've got two vehicles, they can write off one as a business vehicle. It's quite likely that we're going to see a surge in some form of consumption to both, on the one hand, increase the write-offs against the income this year, because there is going to be a significant unavailability of write-off potential for a lot of taxpayers this year. So buying a bigger house is potentially one of those. It's something that when you've got more space and you've got more space that's devoted to a home office, then that's a home office deduction. And you can take that against the net square footage of your home. These are the kinds of considerations that will not so much damage consumption, but in fact put pressure on consumers and small business owners to spend. It is also likely to be a factor in demand for computer products. Well, we've had spectacular moves in some of the big companies, and Apple being a really good example of that. Now, the share has gone from 150 to 450 in the space of a little more than a year and a half. And that is spectacular until we start to think about, well, is it because their business has got better, or is it because just that the PE has gone up? Well, the PE back in early 2019 was around 11, and today it's nearly 34. And 34 is a racy price earnings value. So valuations have increased substantially. The share at one point yesterday was, the market cap was at 1.988 billion. Well, that is an extraordinary valuation until we start to think about the fact that all of the last trillion in its valuation has been because of valuation expansion. Now, I've seen, I think, some good arguments that were brought out quite recently about the fact that valuations were high and that the bottom in the market occurs when the valuation is highest. Now, part of the rationale behind that kind of argument is because when you get a big pullback and there is a lot of earnings, I guess, uncertainty, well, the earnings disappear. The price falls, but not as much as the earnings do. So then you get this really quite aggressive multiple at important market lows. Well, when we look at this overlay chart of the market cap of the S&P 500 with the price earnings ratio, we can see that there was a process of valuation contraction between 2017 and the beginning of 2018. And then it changed. So now we've got a condition where that valuation contraction ended at the beginning of 2018 and valuations started to expand. And really, valuations have taken off like a rocket over the course of the last 4 months. And in fact, the valuation has been rising at an even faster clip than the market cap has. So it's all about price and less about earnings. So now what investors are hoping for is that we're going to see a really quite significant rebound in earnings to help the valuation to improve and to justify the prices. Well, it's potentially possible. But if that is the case, we're definitely going to have an inflationary problem. So we're now in a rather interesting scenario because the bull case for stocks is now 100% dependent on inflationary pressures rising. Because the only possible way that you can justify the PE ratio where it is today is if you think that economic activity is going to rebound in an incredibly robust manner. But if it does, if that is in fact the case, well, then it's going to put pressure on central banks, and central banks are not able to raise interest rates. The cost that would incur for the US government, for example, would be a 200 basis point move would be $100 billion in additional interest payments on the national debt per annum. So that is going to create a rather difficult environment. It's basically the classic debt trap. So we are in a catch-22 situation. The reality here is that central banks are inhibited from raising interest rates. The stock market has already priced that in, and now the stock market is pricing in the very real potential that we're going to have inflationary issues. Well, the two types of assets that do well during inflation are those with limited supply and those that can grow their margins faster than the rate of inflation. Well, in an inflationary environment, companies get pricing power back. And that, therefore, would be where we start to see inflation popping up first, because we're likely to start to see the price of goods increase. Now, this is before we even begin to think about the implications of an increasing trade war between the USA and China. What we saw in here today, I thought, was really very instructive. Tencent pulled back rather sharply and found support intraday in the region of the previous peak and the psychological 500 Hong Kong dollar level. After President Trump announced that WeChat was going to be banned from the USA. Now, the reality, of course, is that when we look at the earnings for the company, the vast majority, 95%, come from mainland China. So that is not going to have a big effect on the share from a domestic ability to generate capital or generate profits. It's going to be a problem for a lot of the Chinese diaspora around the world because they use WeChat for communication, for entertainment, and a lot of them for remittances and for banking. So they're no longer going to have access to updates from the App Store or from US App Stores as a result of this measure. What, of course, it also does is it calls into question Tencent's ability to continue to grow internationally. The company has got significant positions in games like Fortnite and League of Legends, and that may now start to come, or its ability to invest in US companies is going to come into question as a result of this. But then we have to start thinking about, well, where is this all going? There is very little chance that the Chinese administration are going to bow to the demands for greater governance and greater transparency in their actions. Perhaps the more important development in here over the course of the last 24 hours has been the fact that the Trump administration is now also demanding that Chinese companies submit to U.S. audits, because at the moment there are a substantial number of large Chinese companies that are listed in the USA and are not audited in the U.S. but are audited in China, and listing agents and stock exchanges have no access to those audits. We've obviously seen that companies like Luckin Coffee were built on a house of cards, and now we're looking at the potential that the audit trails for a lot of additional Chinese companies are also going to be examined. So companies like JD.com have also done spectacularly well over the course of the last few months, and they also have got clear overbought conditions. We can also then think about the semiconductors index, and AMD has just gone vertical in the last 3 weeks, so it's extraordinarily overbought. And we can also think about the fact that every other time it has become this overbought, in fact, it's never been this overbought, but when it's become very overbought in the past, it has reverted back to the mean. that would represent a very significant pullback from where current levels are. It does really raise the potential that we are in a process now of mean reversion, that we've had such a spectacular advance that it is past time before we now get some consolidation. And I think when we then look at gold prices, they're rallying for much the same reason that those big stocks have been rallying, because investors are looking for a hedge against potential inflation. And the clear correlation between the 10-year TIPS yield, which has been compressing on a daily basis and was positive in here today and on exactly the same day that gold was negative, it does suggest that investors are very clearly and closely monitoring this correlation. And with this wide overextension relative to the trend mean, which is still in negative territory for TIPS yields, then we are potentially now on the cusp of some consolidation within the gold market. But it's important to highlight the fact that gold has broken out to a new all-time high, and it raced to get there. It's not like we saw a lengthy range below a big level and then a substantial breakout. Gold was trading at about $1,470 in March, and as recently as this week, it was as high as $2,075. So we've had a very meaningful move on the upside, and we're due some consolidation. Now, today's move was at one point a downside key reversal. It did not close below the low of last week, so it's more like an outside week. But if we get downside follow through on Monday, well, then that will signal a peak of near-term significance and the potential that we're going to get a process of mean reversion. Now, one thing that we can certainly know about gold, and that historically has been the case, well, or I guess one of the adages that David developed over the years was don't pay up for commodities. And the reason for that is they tend to have sawtooth profiles. Now, what I mean by that is when they rally, they very often pull back into the underlying range. So when you are buying the breakout, you are running the risk that you're going to have to sit through a multi-month period of underperformance. And that kind of experience is debilitating to sentiment. Of course, having the forbearance to wait for the pullback means that you have got to be a true believer in the bull market. You have to believe that prices are going to improve after a period of weakness. Of course, that also means that when you have conditioned yourself to buy the dip, it means that you will inevitably have your conviction strengthened every time that strategy works. That's exactly what's happened with investors in Amazon. Amazon has been the buy the dip market over the course of the last decade. Every time it has pulled back in a meaningful fashion, and it has done that, and by that I mean it has pulled back in a meaningful fashion about once every 2 years. The last time it pulled back in a very meaningful fashion was at the end of 2018. It pulled back quite sharply in March, although not nearly as much as previously. So it's reasonable to assume that investors have been conditioned. When Amazon pulls back by 20 or 30%, they buy. And as long as the bull market persists, then that is something that will keep them in good stead. But eventually it will stop working, and that will be the top. So buying the dips and waiting for significant pullbacks following an acceleration on the upside is the most mature way of looking at the market. But one thing that I've certainly noticed over the course of the last 17 years is that, or something that Richard Russell used to say, it's that there's no fever like gold fever, and that people tend to get extremely emotional about gold, perhaps more so than other asset classes. It encourages people to rush in and to buy the accelerations. And when you're in a new bull market, that even that eagerness to buy in an acceleration higher will be eventually rewarded because prices will recover. But you generally have to wait perhaps a few months, maybe even a year or two, before those higher prices will be surmounted once more. The best time to buy gold is following those pullbacks in exactly the same way as we've seen with Amazon over the course of the last 12 years. And Amazon is also due now to have some consolidation. A lot of good news has already been priced in. But we also have this tailwind of central bank activity, because it's not simply that central banks continue to increase the size of their balance sheets, but that governments are also actively running massive deficits. And that figure right now is $1.2 trillion a quarter, and that's an international figure. So when we start to string it all together, the size of central bank balance sheets are 27 trillion, and deficits are increasing by 1.2 trillion a quarter. Well, then we have to start to think that this is a phenomenal amount of money, that inflationary pressures are certainly rising, and it is inevitable that we're going to start to see pricing pressure coming through. We've already started to see that in Mrs. Tracy's business because she has been on the phone over the last week, every evening in the last week, talking to suppliers in China. Generally, at this time of the year, she'd be in China already. And what she's basically doing now is buying up all existing inventory for anything that is gold or rhodium or silver plated, because prices from last year have doubled for existing inventory. But if you want to buy new inventory, in other words, pay them to manufacture, then prices have tripled. So that is going to be a factor in anything that requires gold or silver or rhodium to as a use case for manufacturing. Now, one of the biggest industrial uses for silver are solar cells. So the entire rationale for this continued bullish move in solar investments has been the continuous contraction of the cost of production of solar cells. Well, we are definitely going to start to see that the input costs for producing these types of hardware products is going to increase. But at the same time, we can think about the massive amount of money that governments are willing to spend and central banks are willing to print, and where is that money going to go? Well, the Biden administration, if in fact they win the election, is intent upon a green infrastructure build. If the Trump administration wins the US election, then they're looking at $1 trillion for infrastructure development of other kinds. The ECB in the EU is looking at a massive infrastructure build in terms of renewable energy. So that is the primary reason that we're seeing this continued investment and action and interest in the renewable sector, because solar has now broken through the $50 area, so that's a meaningful move. The wind sector has continued to extend the breakout from its lengthy range. I think it looks better supported. We've also seen that the interest in hydrogen has been improving as well. And some of these shares had pulled back rather sharply and are finding support in the region of their respective trend means. But of course, one of the major imports for hydrogen fuel cells is, or excuse me, inputs is platinum. Well, platinum prices pulled back rather sharply in here today. It has also posted a downside key reversal today from around this psychological $1,000 level. The big losers today from the announcement of additional ramping up of stress between the USA and China were industrial resources, and copper prices also pulled back sharply. Now, copper is somewhat overextended relative to the trend mean, and it could yet pull back to the trend mean, but the most important thing it's done has been to break the downtrend. So it would suggest that it's likely to be a buy the dip type of scenario, provided it can first demonstrate support somewhere between 280 and 260. When we look at, for example, some of the lesser or I guess the mid-tier copper producers, then they've also been able to break their respective sequences of lower rally highs. Some of the bigger producers also share this characteristic. Antofagasta, for example, broke successfully through the 1000 P level in here this week. I think it is more likely than not that we're due some consolidation, but that's all it's likely to be because there is a strong likelihood that we're going to have continued investment in the industrial resources sector. And one of the most encouraging factors is that commodities are by and large still cheap. The continuous commodity index has rebounded impressively from about 325 to 400. Now, it's also somewhat overbought in the short term and quite likely to now consolidate. If it can hold the region of the trend mean, that would be really extremely encouraging. And then we would have, I think, a higher reaction low. We would have clearer evidence that we're back in a bull market environment. And I think it would be a green light for commodity investing. There is the potential here that what we are now in is a situation very similar to the late 1960s. I do think, though, that there is an argument that things just move faster today. So it's quite likely, I think, that's inflationary pressures are going to surprise on the upside next year. And what we can think about is there is going to be a lot of infrastructure development. On the one hand, we need infrastructure to help to employ people and get people back to work. And particularly the less employed people who need manual labor or just need grunt work, then that is exactly the kind of person that's required to help build out infrastructure. So that is certainly one of the arguments for why governments will invest in it. Then, of course, there is the increasing competition between the USA and China. So that is obviously then going to create a demand factor for more resilience. And resilience is likely to be the buzzword of at least the next 5 or 6 years in both Europe and in the USA. They need to create their own domestic manufacturing for vital ingredients. Whether that is for pharmaceuticals or for semiconductors, it's absolutely essential and it is likely to be a significant demand factor for duplication of existing infrastructure in a number of different geographical locations. So that's another driver for infrastructure development. Then we can think about what all of this means in terms of military hardware, because there is also the clear need to beef up the military preparedness when geopolitical tensions rise, and that is also likely to represent a significant call on commodity production. Therefore, I do think that despite the short-term risk of consolidation, that we are probably now back in a new bull market for commodities, and not least because we are also in a new inflationary cycle, and commodities are hard assets of reasonably limited supply. So that's an additional consideration. When we think about what are the kinds of things that would do well in a new inflationary cycle, well then, hard assets certainly fall into that category, and so do stocks that regain pricing power. Of course, not all stocks will be able to regain pricing power. Those that have pricing power will succeed, those that don't won't. Therefore, we are in an interesting scenario because this is very clearly now the third psychological perception stage of the bull market. At the end of major bull markets, we usually get an inflationary scare. Now, of course, on this occasion, the debt mountain is even larger than it was in the last two occasions. The reason that the bull market in the late 1990s peaked was not only because of Y2K and the fact that it pulled forward earnings from further and further into the future, and sales evaporated in the early 2000s, but then also because the Federal Reserve was raising interest rates. Well, perhaps the response that we're getting today, like the 1960s with the massive street protests, with the rise of, in that case, back then it was a populist movement that was very progressive in nature. We're getting a rise in the progressive movement again on this occasion. The rise of populism has been going on for much longer, though, but so far it has been limited to right-wing populism. When left-wing populism takes place, well, then spending ramps up even more, taxes rise more, and censorship increases. These are not market-friendly events. But the reality is that we're in a situation where there is no ability of central banks to raise interest rates, and therefore there is the scope that we are still going to see this bubble inflate further, that we will see valuations not just get to unreasonable levels, but get to truly extraordinary levels. That's the potential outcome. So even though we've got these extremely overbought conditions, there is the scope that with continued monetary and fiscal stimulus, that we will see even higher levels for the best performing stocks. But it's important to highlight that those stocks have done spectacularly well, and gold shares are doing better right now. But even gold shares, having rallied really very spectacularly off the lows in March, are due some consolidation, and they've pulled back over the last 3 weeks. I do think we're due a pause. We're getting a pause. The reaction that we saw in May and June was approximately $5 in size. It's not at all beyond the bounds of possibility that we would get a somewhat larger pullback from the highs put in earlier this week. But the big difference is that gold shares have only broken out in the last 5 months, and some of those shares, like Amazon and Apple, have been rallying for 12 years. So it's reasonable to conclude that gold shares have further to go on the upside. They also have greater potential for dividend increases. The one thing that we're seeing right across the commodities sector, it was something that appeared in the gold mining sector between about 2013 and 16, that the all-in sustaining cost was imposed upon gold miners by investors. Investors wanted to know where positive cash flows were going to appear. So they forced miners to figure out, what the sustaining cost of production would be. Not simply what the cash cost they had received in the last quarter was, but what they thought that they could produce at on an ongoing basis. So that was a really quite innovative solution to try and instill confidence once more in gold mining stocks. What we are now starting to see is that some of the shale producers are not quite on the cusp of producing an all-in sustaining cost, but they are cutting back on debt. They have stopped drilling, and they are looking much more at the bottom line. So Devon Energy this week announced that they are selling off part of their business. They are cutting their debt in half. They have announced a special dividend. These are all investor-friendly type of actions. It holds out the prospect that the unconventional oil and gas sector, which has gone through exactly the same kind of profligate spending spree that the gold miners went through, is now coming out the other end of that. And some companies will go bust, but those that survive will be much leaner and in a much better position to compete. What it also suggests is that the oversupply of oil, which has really contributed to the weakness in the price, is going to dissipate. It does not mean that oil prices are going to surge past $80. And we may yet see some additional consolidation, and not least because of some of the downward pressure we've seen, for example, on copper prices. But it does look like that supply is coming out of the market at these levels, and that the marginal cost of production will have to improve and be rationalized within the shale sector in order to create a more sustainable business model. Well, that pretty much ensures that we're going to see the biggest marginal contributor to the global supply situation rationalize. Then that holds out the prospect that we will see higher prices in the oil market. The really big strength of the unconventional oil and gas sector is its elasticity. So when prices do get back up towards $70 and $80, then they will increase supply substantially, because all they need to do is start drilling again to increase supply. But supply today is likely to contract because they've stopped drilling. There is usually about a 3 or 4 month lag between when they stop drilling and when production enters a precipitous decline. And it's probably been about 3 months. So it does suggest that we are going to see US production of oil contract considerably. And it may already be showing up in natural gas. Natural gas prices have rebounded in here this week, broken the downtrend over the course of the last 18 months, and that potentially is suggesting that the clear trend of massive increases in supply is now being contained. One thing we also know is that natural gas has probably been a lead indicator, or at least a template for what we can expect from oil, that every time natural gas prices pull back below about $2, then supply is inhibited and then we see a rebound. When prices get back above $4, then we start to see a significant increase in supply. And I do think that that is what we're likely to see with oil, except that the range is probably somewhere around $35 to $80. And we're really at the lower side of that range for oil prices today, which suggests that we're seeing supply destruction in real time. Now, I did mention at the beginning I wanted to talk about additional technological innovation. One thing that I thought was quite an interesting development that I saw today or this week was the discussion about microwave transmission of electricity. And it's a New Zealand company is thinking about how to do that. Now, that means that they are talking about getting rid of transmission wires. Now, when you go through this interview with the CEO of the company, then one thing that they talk about is that it's acoustic metamaterials that they're using. That's the same kind of material that was used in the stealth bomber. And they're using these materials to both transmit and receive microwaves. So that's an interesting phenomenon, and it's a commercial use for a very significant military technology. Now, if we just look at what they look like, it's exactly the same kind of dull material that the stealth planes were using, but it is not as efficient as the copper wires. So it's not going to replace copper wires over land, but it could quite easily be an interesting phenomenon for offshore, and particularly for offshore wind, which has been a significant growth industry. But it does suggest that there are alternatives, that there are ways of transmitting electricity that we probably haven't thought about, and that these are significant evolutions. Then, over the course of the last week, we've also seen that Rolls-Royce has teamed up with Virgin Galactic to think about how they can produce a hypersonic vehicle. Well, Rolls-Royce has compressed by over 80% since 2018, going from 1,000 to 200. And obviously that's a really very significant decline. Now, one thing that we can also think about is that we had the acceleration, and now we've had this sequence of failed downside brakes. Well, this looks like a Type 2 bottom. The defining characteristic of a Type 2 bottom is a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. We have not seen that yet for Rolls-Royce. It is too close to the global air sector to have had the massive reaction against the prevailing trend today, because obviously there is all of this uncertainty about airlines. But people are queuing up with ideas about how to spend their money. And a lot of people, despite the fact that we've got maybe 15 or 20% unemployment, the other 80% of people are flush with cash. And the number of, plastic surgery operations that have been booked, they're solid booked through until the beginning of next year. So that tells us that certainly people have got consumable money. When do we get a vaccine? And it is likely we're going to have a vaccine for the coronavirus. Well, then people are going to want to go on vacation. And certainly our family has been sort of locked at home and trying to enjoy the best of the beach here in Los Angeles. But we have certainly missed our trips to Asia this year. It's quite likely that the airline sector is going to survive, that they may be functionally insolvent at today's valuations, but that governments are just not going to allow airlines to go bust. And then that will be positive for companies like, engine providers like Rolls-Royce. Of course, when we start to think about Virgin Galactic and Rolls-Royce, well, the UK has been investing in development for hypersonic vehicles for most of the last 30 years. And the Sabre engine is the air-breathing engine that can go up to Mach 5 is also approaching the potential for commercialization. So this is another example of a military technology from what was effectively 60 to 70 years ago now entering the potential for commercialization. it is quite likely that we are going to see hypersonic travel approaching commercial reality at some point in the next decade. And that is most particularly true for lifting payloads to space. SpaceX went through their first, or I think it was their second test for their BFR in here this week. And that is going to massively decrease the cost of lift to space. Now, when we think about that interview with the microwave transmission of energy, they were also talking about the potential for solar panels in space. Now, that's not something that is even remotely possible today because of the cost of lift. But lift costs are decreasing all the time. There is the very clear potential that within a decade we're going to see orbital power plants. And that is something that is also completely not in the stock market today. When we start to think about the green innovation that is on the cusp of commercialization, it's not even an argument any longer about whether it's commercial, because we have got governments lining up to devote trillions to this sector. And it does suggest that it is renewable energy is likely to be the big bull market of the 2020s. That's certainly something that is likely to be beneficial in terms of the stock market, at least. Now, we can also think about the news today that Biogen is having another run at its Alzheimer's treatment. Well, we can go back and think about the major decline that we had. I think it was this decline was the failure of the their trial. Then we had another pop on the upside on good earnings, popped on the upside today because they're moving ahead with their Alzheimer's drug. The price has gone nowhere for the last 6 years, and they definitely do need something. But one of the things I think is particularly interesting about Alzheimer's is that it affects mostly older people, and the result of investigating how older people evolve the disease is contributing to greater knowledge about aging, and that the majority of the solutions that are being proposed for Alzheimer's contribute to younger, or I guess the improvement in cognitive function that approaches youth. So there is the real potential that in attempting to solve Alzheimer's, that we are going to open up the much bigger market of anti-aging. Now, anti-aging technology has primarily focused on cosmetics forever. But with gene technology, with the evolution of biotechnology, that of gene editing, gene sequencing, and synthetic biology, that we are going to see much greater commercialization of these technologies over the course of the next decade. And then that is likely to be a very profound change in terms of the bull market overall. The cost to national health services of Alzheimer's is profound, and it is likely to get much worse over the coming decades, or at least the coming decade, as the baby boomer generation ages out and also becomes the longest lived of any generation in history. So that is something that is going to create a lot more investment, and that there will be additional solutions. Alzheimer's is a completely unmet market, so the market potential for growth for any kind of permitted solution is incredibly profound. And again, the fact that the biotech sector has gone nowhere for most of the last 5 years and is now putting in a first step above the base is also supportive of the view that we are in a new bull market. So that all suggests that we are in a potential rotation, that even though we still see accelerations on the upside for large cap growth, that there are additional sectors that are likely to outperform over the next decade. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.